Well, the Thurman biography, I mean, it crisscrosses. We won't be talking about it in our class, for sure, and that is, of course, we're talking about it now and giving it away, but in 1948, he was in his mid-40s. I think he was governor of South Carolina at that time. And if you may recall, in terms of party politics, that the Democratic Party controlled the South solidly from the 1870s up to about this, well, a little later than this, in the 1960s. In 1948, Harry Truman, when he decided to run for re-election, put together a package called the Fair Deal, and in the Fair Deal there was some pretty way-out stuff for 1948. There was like national health insurance, which we still don't have, and low-cost housing, which has come to be federally financed housing. But also the first comprehensive civil rights packages was put forward by Truman as a campaign promise. And that was too much for a number of Southern Democrats, because the Democratic Party had stayed together a long, long time by making sure that equality for black people wasn't an issue. That's what kept Northern and Southern Democrats united, even through the FDR days. So while FDR gets credit for bringing the black vote over to the party, that was only from an economic class perspective, surely not from a civil rights perspective. So when Truman made a Missourian made this attempt to introduce civil rights, J. Strom Thurmond, the governor, decided he would run as a third-party candidate on what was called the Dixiecrats, or the States' Rights Democratic Party, knowing that he would take not only South Carolina but probably most of the Deep South states with him out, and that would cause Truman to lose. So it was a punishing measure to try to teach the Democratic Party don't go doing civil rights. And in addition to that, there was another Democrat who broke from the party, former Vice President Henry Wallace, who had been Secretary of Commerce, got on the wrong side of Truman concerning how to deal with the Russians, and so he ran as a third-party candidate, progressive candidate. He became pretty marginalized when most of the American Communist Party and Socialist Party came out and endorsed him. That cooked his chances for winning. But still, he took some liberal votes with him away from Truman. So liberal votes in the North going away from Truman, Southern votes going for Thurman, and Truman still won that election over John Dewey of New York. And you may have seen pictures of him holding up the newspaper and smiling where it says Dewey defeats Truman, because a New York newspaper, or a Chicago paper, had assumed already the night before he was going to lose and printed up the paper early. So that's that famous election. And Thurman then was later elected to the Senate in the 50s. And again, on attacking a civil rights bill, he gave the longest filibuster in the history of the Senate, 22 hours and 15 minutes. And he said it was for states' rights, but I can't think of anybody who's so impassioned they would stand for 24 hours and speak about the vague concept of states' rights. I think it was just racism is all I can attribute it to. Well, in the mid-60s, early 60s, Southern Democrats that were opposed to segregation began to come over to the Republican Party, and that wasn't so much because Republicans are prejudiced. I'm not going to say that. That's not fair, because look at Win Rockefeller. He was very, very open-minded in Arkansas. But it was because they were sick and tired of all the liberalism. In addition to civil rights, it was also big government, big economic programs. So there's a mass exodus of Southern white politicians out of the Democratic Party. And Thurman's one of them, and he keeps getting elected to the Senate just with a party change. And so Thurman stays in the Senate till 2003 or something like that. I think maybe he retired. Maybe in the 2002 election he didn't run for re-election. But he was still alive at 101. And so here was this guy who had the longest record. Even Robert Byrd hasn't matched that yet in the Senate. And here's where the story gets good. At a birthday party when he was 101, Trent Lott, and who's Trent Lott, or who was Trent Lott? And is again, I guess. Senator from Mississippi, whose home was, his coastal home was destroyed in Katrina. And he is currently fighting insurance companies on the grounds that they say that he didn't have flood insurance, and he said it was wind-driven rain that caused the damage, and he and others are probably going to win that suit. But Trent Lott went to Strom Thurmond's birthday party, and where the cameras and the microphones could hear him, leaned over and said to Strom Thurmond, you know, if you just won that presidential election back in 1948, we wouldn't have had all of these problems. Now, you could almost console him for wishing an old man, you know, well in his past, and not really meaning to imply what you implied, except Trent Lott had said that at three or four different birthday occasions for him. So this was a standard line for Lott. So if he had won the 1948 election, what problems would have been prevented? Equality? Civil rights? Those are the problems that occurred? And so it looked pretty bad. And instantly, being Senate Majority Leader, his party turns on, this is on Trent Lott, and starts to make plans to remove him, and he appeals to Bush, and Bush turns a deaf ear and doesn't defend him. So he goes on BET, remember, on BET for a half hour, and while he was welcomed on the channel, he didn't save his soul in the party. So he was canned and replaced with Fritz, wasn't it, Bill Fritz of Tennessee, who thought about running for president and has dropped out of that race. But recently, since the new shakeup of Democrats taking over control of the Senate, in the new lineup of minority positions, Mitch McConnell is the Senate minority leader, and second to minority leader is, what's the position that's second to majority or minority leader in the Senate or House? Whip, yeah. So, therefore, oddly enough, Trent Lott becomes a bad name here, the minority whip. Okay, that's just the introduction to the story. And the best part of the story is, I was going to say the best part is that Strom Thurmond died. I didn't mean that. Thurmond's passed away, that's part of the story. After his passing, it is discovered that he's fathered an illegitimate child with a maid from back in the 1920s, who he has privately taken responsibility for and paid for the child and her throughout all those years. And then other relations have popped up when it was discovered on Sunday night that his folks, Thurmond's relatives, once owned Al Sharpton's folks as slaves. And that's where all this got into the news. And so Sharpton was admittedly shocked by the whole situation. And then there was a spokesperson for the South Carolina Republican Party who came out and said, well, it's pretty hard to find anybody in South Carolina that either wasn't a slave or owned a slave, relatives-wise. Which is extremely historically wrong, because 80% of the people in the South did not own slaves. And they're 90%. It was a very few people that actually owned slaves. So was she just dreaming of a different past there or what? So interesting news stories. Sometimes they announce things like that just because you know it's going to be great for class. Not for life, but for discussing in class. Well, back to the past. Here we are on item 2 of the 1890s to 1914 foreign policy and domestic politics study. What we were doing after, number one, we looked A through D. We talked about those thematic factors which caused America to splurge into and flirt with imperialism or expansionism from 1890 to about 1904. Then we listed some people who were proponents of expansionism in item 2. Roosevelt, who would later become a president. Henry Cabot Lodge, senator from Massachusetts. Albert J. Beveridge, Indiana senator, whose quote we read as the last thing we did together. And one of the things about the quote that I didn't spend as much time on it as I wanted to was how much he had addressed each of the issues in A through D. He talked about pride of the nation and protecting overseas trade and building a navy to protect the overseas trade. And especially the last part we spoke about, where he formulated this idea that while we would own, or they'd be under the U.S. umbrella, I guess the best way to put it, these foreign lands, they would also be self-governing, some kind of like federalist imagery. That it's almost like people will be glad to be conquered by the Americans, is what Beveridge was forecasting. And most foreign people haven't enjoyed that, but a lot of Americans think they would. And I don't know if that's an ethno-arrogance or if that's just an innocent exuberance to believe that when you have the best religion, the best commercial activity, and the best freedom, and the best documents, who wouldn't want it? I mean, so that's kind of been a part of American foreign policy throughout the 20th century after it became a world power. This next person in the lineup, Alfred Thayer Mahon, a former ship captain who wrote a very important book called The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, published in 1890. In this book, Mahon kind of does a tracing of history of nations in the modern era being since the 1700s. And what Mahon concludes is that every nation that was a significant world power became such. Before I answer this, before I give his thesis away, which is kind of already obvious here, let me back up, and I may have shared this with you already, but there was a C-SPAN book notes commentary with a person who was looking at the origins of slanguage in America, and they were talking about how in other countries there's so many more dialects than there is in the United States, and yet there are actually dialectical differences in the United States, South, North, etc. And the question that was asked was, what's the difference between a dialect and a language? Have I shared this with him before? And the linguist who was being asked said, a language has a navy. Isn't that great? A great definition? Does it make you mad if I explain it? In other words, if you have, what if I do? That's one of the things, the difference between high school and college teaching. If you explain your jokes in high school, they love it. If you do it here, you get the look. But what he meant by that was that it's not really set in stone what are proper rules for language. Who has the power to force their language on someone else is what makes it more than a dialect and an official language. So working from that perspective, this is Mayan's theme, not that he wants to force language on people, but he says great nations were those who had great navies. Great navies that protected overseas influence, trade, and bases. And in fact, great nations not only had navies, but had overseas bases to protect and refurbish those navies, to protect interests. So what he's advocating is if the United States, which is just groping desperately to be considered a world power, they no longer want to be seen the infant new colonies, a new nation. They want to be seen, because of the industrial growth and the power of the Gilded Age, they want to be perceived as one of the world powers to be reckoned with. And so building a large navy is exactly what Mayan and others, Lodge and Beveridge and Roosevelt and others will all agree to. So this, as it says here in item three, there's a great expansive naval buildup that takes place in those years. And in that day and age, the navy was perceived as the front line defense, just as maybe air power would have been perceived in World War II as the major line of defense or offense, and as maybe atomic or nuclear weapons today would be perceived as the major first line of defense. And it comes back to that thing that we mentioned earlier about military-industrial complex that we mentioned, that Eisenhower warned against in his farewell speech, that we've seen in such more flagrant, blatant ways in other countries, but it is the building of a military that seems to couple with the growth of industry and overseas markets at the same time. And Mayans, without any abashment, is just saying, this is what America needs to be great. And the others agreed with him, and the social Darwinist attitudes and the jingoistic feelings all, you know, play into this. And there's almost this feeling that if we don't get into the race, the Europeans are going to get it before we get it. And so if somebody's got to get it, it ought to be the right people that get it. Well, here we have been flirting with expansionism and imperialism. Let's get to stealing some land here. Item four. Liberating land. How Hawaii became American soil. The first time that Americans show interest in Hawaii is as early as the 1820s, pre-Civil War period, when American missionaries go to convert Hawaiians to Christianity. And they're the first to bring back the stories of what's there and what's available in the climate, and especially what can be grown. Following the Civil War, business investors move in and start to develop the sugarcane and pineapple crop. But what's discovered is by the 1870s and 1880s, the native Hawaiian population begins to die off almost at a 90% rate. And this is almost entirely due to diseases acquired from the outside, and influenza and colds, and sadly some venereal disease. And it would be, you know, maybe you'd guess that it would be the whalers and sailors that dropped in that contributed that. But it is proven that missionaries also were a contributing factor to that. So this is the 1870s and 1880s. So if you're going to have profitable growth of sugarcane and pineapples, you need a labor force, and that is why they went to, first to China, and recruited workers. And what happened in Hawaii is the Chinese workers within the first and a half generations saved money, bought property, went into other professions, and there was another lack of labor. So that's why Japanese workers were recruited for the same purpose. And they did the same within a generation activity, and that is to move into professional ranks, buy property. And again, there is an absence of labor, which is the source of Filipino labor. I think I probably said all this in the immigration lecture already. But it does explain why there's such a diverse population in Hawaii. Still, the people who had the most influence and the most money was not the Hawaiian royal family, nor was it these various immigrants from the Far East, but rather it was American investors. And by the late 1880s, these investors had persuaded the king, whose name does not seem to be here. Let's see if I can remember how to spell it on the board here. These are all A's, but that's a U. Kalakaua, something close to that. That was the king of the Hawaiian Islands in the late 1880s. If you've been to Waikiki and gone down that main strip where all the hotels and surf shops and market bazaars are, that's Kalakaua Avenue. There's all one word. In Hawaiian, I don't know. Yeah, it's all one word. They use different symbols at one time. And he was very pliable, very influenced by the American businessmen. They persuaded him to establish a legislature, which they quickly got themselves voted into and dominated. So now here's the legislature in Hawaii that is handing out laws that he's still supposed to approve of, but he approves of everything they want. They work an arrangement where they get a treaty with the United States to where they can sell their sugar into the American markets without tariffs placed upon it, and in return the United States gets a chance to use Pearl Harbor as a naval base. This is all occurring in the late 1880s. And of course, what you can see here is that everything happening is beneficial to American interests, whether it's American businessmen there or from abroad. Well,
they get the treaty to import the sugar in the U.S. without a tariff?
Yes. Uh-huh. Which is going to be somewhat of a contributing factor to two other areas. And that is the Spanish-American War and also the E.C. Knight Company case of 1895, which dealt with the issue concerning the Sherman Antitrust Act. It's hard to deny that the judges on that court did not want to harm a Louisiana sugar company when they were in competition with Cuban and Hawaiian sugar. There's a factor there. Anyway, the queen, Liliuokalani, who's there in item four, which was not only the queen but also the king's wife and sister, which was Hawaiian traditions. You may remember in the novel Hawaii by Michener, they talk a lot about that situation, how the missionaries tried their best to persuade the royal family that was not appropriate and never could seem to get it explained to them. So. Anyway, the queen became disenchanted with all this influence that the Americans are exerting, and so she deposes the king and declares herself the sole monarch and declares that she's going to dismiss or disband the legislature and just rule by fiat. This is in 1893 when this occurs. And not impressed with that, the American businessmen instead stage a coup and overthrow her and place her under house arrest. And one of the convenient things that come to assist is there is an American gunboat called the Boston, which happens to be just offshore at the time of this coup, which dispatches Marines to come ashore and make sure that no lives or property are endangered, and so the coup is successful. So the question is, did the U.S. government know ahead of time of this staged coup, and if so, did they send the ship with American sailors in order to help overthrow the island? A book I bought a year ago and read like two chapters of, and I don't know if I'll ever finish, it's good though, it's called Overthrow. And it's the history of where Americans have overthrown governments from the 1800s all the way to the present. And some of it's kind of strained. Some of it is we were involved in the planning stages for somebody else, and he counts that as an American overthrow. But this is one of the cases where he really talks how blatantly the United States just without shame just overthrew the monarch of Hawaii to protect our business and strategic military interests here. This occurs, this overthrow of the queen occurs at the very end of the Harrison administration in his lame duck period. And by the time it's finished and Hawaiian leaders, or American Hawaiian government leaders, are asking for annexation, Cleveland has been not only elected but now has moved from president-elect to being inaugurated. And once Cleveland takes office, he wasn't in on the overthrow, and after hearing of what happened, he sent a commission to investigate what happened. And the commission came back and reported to Cleveland that the majority of native Hawaiians are not in harmony with what's happened. They want their queen restored, and they want de-emphasis of American influence. But that would mean Cleveland would have to send American military personnel to overthrow American people. And so while he continues to condemn what's happened, he does nothing about it. So that leaves American business interest in charge of Hawaii from 1893 until 1898, declaring themselves an independent republic, led by pineapple grower Sanford Dole, D-O-L-E. I often get the question, is he related to Bob Dole? I have no idea. Maybe so. Sanford Dole, D-O-L-E, was the president of Hawaii from 1893 to 1898, as in Dole Pineapple. Five years later, in 1898, the climate and mood of the United States had changed, and the presidency had changed. Cleveland was no longer in office. McKinley was. It was in the summer, July going into August, when the Spanish-American War was already underway. And attitudes in those 5 years had changed greatly towards imperialism and expansionism. And so a very non-eventful, non-confronted congressional vote brought Hawaii in 1898 as a territory. And Hawaii remained a U.S. territory until what year when it became a state? Yep, 1959. And maybe this will date me a little bit. I can remember 1959, at 7 years old, in an elementary school, we were talking about how 48 stars on a flag could be turned into a 50 grid. And we were all experimenting on the chalkboard as kids how to line up 49 instead of 50 to look most decorative. And that was in January of the year when Alaska joined, and it's the 49th state. And then in August of that year, Hawaii joined on, I think it was August 21st or August 1st, that Hawaii joined. And I remember being in Southern California on vacation with my parents, watching a parade and asking why the parade was there, and it's because Hawaii had become the 50th state. McKinley, William McKinley, who won the 96 election against, you know who? Who did McKinley beat in 96? Bryan, Warren Jennings Bryan, the boy orator of the Platte, or the great commoner, as he was called. Next, the Spanish-American War. And I wrote a box of thoughts over here to the side to kind of discuss about wars. When I was talking about foreign policy before, I mentioned that our foreign policy had often been built around protecting overseas trade or defending ourselves and our interests if we're attacked, but that often we were engaged in more of an isolationist streak than a desire to be international. Well, I meant to kind of combine war discussion in with that in the vagueness, but of the wars we've been in, I'd say compared to other parts of the world, for being a big power and being able to do a lot of damage, we've been more justified in our wars than most nations. Now, I know a lot of flaming leftists like me won't agree to that, but I really think that's the case. Is that let's talk for a second about wars from the beginning of the country up to 1898, up to the Spanish-American War, and assess the why we got into them reasons, and see how honorable or less than honorable they've been. The Revolutionary War. Purpose? Not pay taxes. Or at least not pay taxes we didn't get to vote on. Was that pretty honorable? I'd say in the bigger picture, yes, because it got to be more than taxes. I'm being sarcastic about the taxes. It really got to be a case of being able to run your own affairs free from the interference of the mother country. And it wasn't like we were just rude from the start. We did a lot of requesting and appropriate steps before. They're the rude ones, and so therefore that led to the war. So what was the next war after the Revolutionary War? And let's go with major wars rather than little skirmishes with French in 6 months periods and things. Yes, War of 1812. And as I was driving over, I was thinking, that's the one that to me seems the most unusual, because there's no spark. Most of our war studies, you can have long-range buildup and then something happens like Tonkin Gulf or something of that effect. But in 1812, there had been fights with Indians in the year before that. There had been some ships that had been impressed on the open seas. But in June of 1812, when war was declared, there was not an immediate specific battle or event that said that was the tipping point. So we got into that war with a buildup of feeling. And what was the reason for getting into that? There's purpose to doing all this background check here because it makes us be able to assess Spanish-American War a little better. You're right. It's we're caught up in their war, yes, and we're attacked from both sides, and our what we feel is our right to trade as a neutral where we want to is being interrupted. So it is a protect our interests, protect our rights, but it's also kind of a protect our prestige. We're not going to be pushed around. Someone else may cut and run, but we're going to defend who we are. And so there, that's the one. That's the side of it that everybody always remembers. What's the side that also, I'd say a 50% cause that we just don't talk about the reason for the War of 1812? Why we declared war on Britain and leave, make it all a Western Hemisphere answer.
Didn't Britain and America share the
Northwest Corner? There you go. Well, they had Canada, we had up to the Great Lakes. Even though, I'm glad you said this. Looking at that map, the British had Canada, and up until 1803, we had what? This blue section of Europe. What was going on? Even though that was officially U.S. soil, what was going on in that area that was a contributing factor to the war?
The British had forts.
Yes, the British had forts up here, and they were doing what?
Why?
Well, the Indians definitely had a reason to protect themselves from illegal white aliens coming across the Ohio River and the Appalachian Mountains and stealing their land. But why were the British doing this?
Because they had a
fur trade going with the Indians on American soil. So the Indians and the British saw an alliance together, a commercial alliance, but also there's a military advantage to the British doing this. Americans had always dreamed of stealing Canada. And so rather than leave a lot of British troops in that area, you arm the Indians, they'll do the work for you, they want to protect their own land anyway. And fur trade can go on, and so can the defense, and keep the Americans out of their own land. So it's the case of the British are dissing us twice, on the open seas and in our own soil. So how would you, put it all together, how would you assess the War of 1812? Good reasons, bad reasons? Was it a war we should have engaged in? It's hard. Well, maybe that's bad to do a 2007 question about an 1812 feature. Let's say what was on their minds. Those who voted for that war wanted what? Land and prestige. So then we get into where I want to go with this on the issues, and that is that I was trying to. What are consistent issues that pop up in our wars? Obviously, one of them has to be defending ourselves from attack. When we are endangered or attacked or mistreated, like being attacked on the open seas. Or in this case, try to move into our own land and see, and of course it's the tricky issue of our Native Americans, Americans. At this point, they're British agents. So they're endangering the right to settle on their own land. So there's a defense and protection reason for that. But there is also this opportunity for aggrandizement, the ability to make money or the ability to find a strategic place to defend your interests from, and that would be much more profitable and strategic to, on the open seas and in that land to fight Britain if we could win. And then there's the liberate concept. Lots of times we get into wars, and we do this a lot more than most countries, going into war because somebody is abused, somebody is enslaved, somebody needs to be freed. And lots of times we make fun of wars that have done that, but in reality that's been a strong contributing factor to our involvement. It may not have been the one that would get us in to start with, but after we're in for some other reason, it sure is one that can keep us there. Civil War being an example. It's to keep the Union, but then it can become the ethical free the slaves issue. So, liberate people, protect our interests, defend against attack, advanced policy. I think this last one we do the least, and that's advancing strategic commercial opportunities, I think, because that one has the ugly side to it, and I think we do that the least. After the War of 1812, Civil War. Reason? Really, slavery. Starting off with union, but then eventually resulting in the abolition of slavery. Do you know of any other country on the planet that tore itself up into a civil war in order to free people at the bottom of the social rung? It's not good to see all those people die, but doesn't that give us some indication that our wars tend to be based on ethics and justice? At least that one carries that image. There's a new book out, which I don't know the title or the author, but it was in Sunday's Inside edition of the paper, in which it talks about the traditional view of World War II being the good war is not so good because of all the atrocities that came from it and the things that Americans learned to do in it. It's a real reversal of our traditional view that of all the wars, World War II was the good one we had to be in. And the author is taking a stab at that. I'm curious to see the book and see if he accomplishes it. But after the Civil War, what's next? The one we're going to do here, the war, Spanish-American War, yeah. And let's give away our punchlines a little. Why do we get into this? Profits, interests, strategic, yes, yes, yes. But that wouldn't have happened had it not been for free Cubans. We want Cuba, but we're freeing Cubans from Spanish rule. And eventually Filipinos from Spanish rule. So it's liberating colonists from European colonialism. As well as there's other reasons that want to drag us there. How about the next one, World War I? After we get in the war, they're our allies. We were very non-aligned and isolationist before that. That's, if you ever saw the movie Reds with Warren Beatty in it, as a reporter who's just back from World War I, he gets up in front of a press corps and is asked why we're in the war, and that's what he says, the one word, profit. But is that what Woodrow Wilson said in front of the Senate when he asked for a war declaration? We want to make profit? And he said, this war is to make the world safe for democracy and fight the war to end all wars. Now, was he cynical or was he sincere? Was sincere. Woodrow Wilson, very, very sincere about if democracies can win this war and readjust the world so that autocracies no longer can invade people, it'll be a just and fair world. It's this Wilsonian attitude that Bush talks about. I mean, there's a link there. So World War I, yes, it was a rerun of the War of 1812 in this sense that submarines were attacking us and British ships were attacking our trade. And so to defend our trade like the War of 1812, we get into it. But it morphs from a defend our trade and prestige perspective to a make this world so no more wars will happen. Of course, World War II, yeah, stop the damn Nazis. I mean, it's got to be that. Which includes their proto-Nazis, the Japanese and the Italians. They were also involved in this too. So it was, but did we get into the war solely from the start because of we must liberate people? No, it turns into that instantly after we're attacked at Pearl Harbor. So it's strategic interests again. Korean War. Yes, stop the spread of communism, which had the North invaded the South. Not only did we, but the United Nations sent troops also from various countries to defend South Korea from an invasion of North Korea. But in the bigger picture, it was obviously the Cold War stopped the spread of communism worldwide, but in a specific place there. So we have a strategic interest here against worldwide communism, but we're also helping the people who've been invaded. Vietnam gets more complicated. We often believe that this was a North-South Vietnam thing, but more so it was a civil war in the South in which North Vietnam, China, and Russia fed the Viet Cong in the South while we took care of the government in the South. So, but it is, again, against that bigger picture of worldwide stopping communism and protecting democracy. The problems there with South Vietnam, which was kind of true for South Korea also, was they just weren't as democratic as they should be for us to defend them. They tend to be pretty one-party state and somewhat quasi-fascist themselves, not as bad as the communists, but enough that it really wasn't role model democracy. But it was better than communism, and so that's why we sided with that. After Vietnam, what war? I think so, yeah, 1991. Is there something in between? Pardon? I still can't hear. Oh, that's 98, isn't it? Yeah, but it's going to. But that's a good one in our story. We're going to get into because it fits the theme I want to go with here in a minute. So I think between 75 and 91, we're pretty. We almost get dragged into the 1980s Central America activity. Maybe it's Grenada, if you want to call that a war, but that's an invasion. Why do we get into the Gulf War? This is real classic. Okay, and there. Okay, we hear oil. Wasn't it to liberate somebody who'd been invaded by a neighbor? Okay, well, that sounds so cynical. You make it sound like if, say, Sudan invaded Chad and there's no oil at risk, we wouldn't do anything about it. Or Rwanda invaded Malawi or something like that, but we wouldn't do anything about it. We didn't. So I'm thinking there is often a parallel that we have some strategic commercial interest at heart that is threatened, but I think it would be hard to just make that the only reason without some kind of free people. Okay, so right there, how many other nations do that? How many other nations tie in a humanitarian effort? No, they just say we're stealing stuff. We've got no guilt. We have no Declaration of Independence to feel guilty about. So that's why I think there's a pattern here that, yes, we, like other nations, engage in protecting our interests, but we feel tied all the time to do it morally and ethically.
No, I think we just take advantage of the fact that we have a humanitarian gain on the way of being able to...
You don't think it's liberate the people and, oh, while we're there, take advantage of the opportunities?
Yeah.
Okay. Liberate and plunder.
Protect our...
So now that we've got ourselves some criteria to work from, our current war, how do we assess that? And before you say we were attacked, Iraqis didn't attack us. Unless all Arabs are the enemy. And that's a thesis you can use there. So, what's the reasoning there? Okay, so here's the interesting point is we believed we were in danger. So it wasn't a response to an attack. It was the response to a perceived, or at least told, we were told, a perceived attack.
And the cops pull you over and they've got reason to suspicion to you on the search of your car.
And even though you've not even reached in the glove compartment, they're so sure you have it, they shoot you. I think preemptive strike. I think that's... They tell you, give over the gun, I don't have the gun, give over the gun, I don't have the gun, bang. Turns out... They look in the glove compartment. There wasn't a gun. But we didn't want to take the risk of a mushroom cloud smoking, as Connolly's rice. That's where this war is so uniquely different, because in previous wars, I can't think of a case where we struck in force out of the perceived threat. It was after being attacked at Pearl Harbor, being attacked, or somebody's invaded.
You think it's because we're gun-shy now?
I mean, that's why we did it, or that's why... Well, very specifically, I think that the reason that we, the public, went along with this, even though we probably knew this wasn't all the full truth, the reason we went along with it is angry about 9/11, definitely associating that terrorist attack with somebody needs to be made to pay for what happened. Couldn't catch bin Laden in Afghanistan, so let's go get somebody that gave us some trouble in the past anyway, Hussein. And I think in the bigger picture, Islamic oil barons, whether they be Persian or Arab, had been pissing us off since 1973, in reality. Making gas prices go from 30 cents a gallon to a dollar a gallon in 1974 and 5 through an embargo. Taking hostages in Iran in 1979. So there was a buildup for those who had a memory of it. We've been pushed far enough. And I think that was a contributing factor. And I think the president knew he could tap into that. So, but you know what? If he had discovered large caches of arsenal, he really would have been praised as being the one who had the foresight to see ahead of time defending our interests. So, and there was also a lot of this liberating the Iraqi people from the torture chambers and the gassings and things that occurred. So there's still that image. I think a lot of people supported that war and still do, even though it's turned bad for us, supported the war on the grounds that we're liberating people from a cruel dictator, Saddam. Like we've been on topic for any time.
There's always things parallels to like today and something that happened in the past. And you know, they always accuse Roosevelt of
Franklin.
During the Japanese coming and everything. And I've heard that they said the same thing to Bush. And they knew that it was happening. I mean,
knew that it wasn't true, but. Knew that. No, okay. I'll defend both presidents from what I've read. That the strongest case made against FDR was a book called The Broken Seal by Leslie Fargo. And it's all innuendo. There's no evidence to back it up. And Stanford professor David Kennedy made the strongest defense of FDR about that, saying that if FDR really wanted into a war with Japan or with the Nazis, that's where it was, to stop the growth of the Nazis, it was very possible to go to war only with Japan. Russia did. Russia didn't go to war with Japan until the last few days. So it's feasible. You didn't have to be at war with all the Axis powers. So if he wanted a war to protect England from Germany, getting one started in your other field from the Japanese attack was not the wisest way to do it. And there just isn't any evidence to prove it. There's a lot of sloppy espionage work that didn't go on, but there's no evidence linking FDR. Of course, I worship FDR, so I don't dare. In fact, to tell you what happened one time, even with the tape running, who cares? There was a substitute at Northside that came over to me and was all excited and wanted to share a new book he was reading. And as soon as what it was a new idea of trying to blame FDR for Pearl Harbor, I just had no courteous words for that man. I just so much I worship FDR. I'm not going to let facts get in the way of what I already believe about FDR. Now, as far as is Bush knowing about 9/11, I don't think so at all. If that was true, I think we would have finally, by this point in time, people of the Clinton administration who have enough experience to know would have accused him. And I don't think Bush is that kind of person. I mean, he surprised me as the kind of person he is and what he'll go to, but I don't think that would ever be in his repertoire. Don't worry about us. Just do what you need to. Don't talk. Yeah, so I don't think that he knew. There's a video called Spare Change, which tries to give that insinuation that he knew and let it happen, but I don't believe it. We as Americans like to believe in big conspiracy theories, but most of the time they're false. Well, with that backdrop of thinking about the wars we've been through, the reasons we've gotten into them, the combination of protecting interests, liberating people, fighting for human rights, defending against an attack, or in our most recent one, defending against a perceived attack. And let me, I want to do some ragging on the president on this last one. A little bit. One of the things I was always proud of the United States for was not pulling Pearl Harbors. That was John F. Kennedy when he was dealing with the Cubans missile crisis. They suggested the best thing to do was knock out those missiles and those launchers and the Russians that were all involved in there before they could become operational to defend the country. And Kennedy just refused on the grounds for, no, I'm not going to be the first president to pull a Pearl Harbor. And of course the blockade worked and things were dismantled and didn't happen. This, to my knowledge, is the first time of that nature a war was started with preemptive strikes. And if you ask a person who remembers Pearl Harbor, is still alive, how did they may not feel that way now, but how did they feel about the Japanese when it happened?
They were all the same. They were all the enemy.
The American Japanese, the Japanese Japanese, and they were for a long damn time. So can you imagine what the rest of the world is thinking about us from doing a preemptive strike? On it turns out reasons that weren't even real. So that's what worries me a lot, is that we crossed a line there we never did as a nation before. Again, if you found the weapons, you'd be the hero. So with this backdrop, let's look at how the Spanish-American War came about. Cuba, in item 8, one of the, if not the last, Spanish colonies in Central America. All the others had liberated themselves in the first part of the century. But Cuba was so valuable for its sugar crop, the Spanish held on to it firmly and tightly and endearingly. Life for Cubans was pretty hellish. Very few owned land. Almost all the land in Cuba was held by absentee Spanish landlords who hired overseers. And it was a kind of a blend between European federalism serfdom and just American slavery of how these people worked the sugar canes. And a majority of the Cuban population being of African descent, not Spanish or native Indian. So that's how Cuba was run. It was like a slave colony in an agricultural sense. There had been, as I see down here in item 9, a war for liberation that occurred between 1868 and 78. Cubans revolted against Spanish control. It was quelled by promises by the Spanish government to put together land reform to allow people to own land and have voice in local government. As soon as the revolution was quelled in 1878, Spanish double-crossed them and provided none of what was agreed to. So that left a history for Cubans that if they go into revolt against the Spanish again, there's not going to be any negotiating or trusting of the Spanish. Now, this 10-year war from 1868 to 78 went fairly unnoticed in American time, or in American eyes, because we were dealing with just watching the French get out of Mexico and also the Reconstruction period of after World War II, or after Civil War, I mean. So there just wasn't a lot of focus or attention on Cuba. By the 1890s, however, there is a great change, and I'll go back to number 8 and explain why. By the 1890s, Americans owned over $50 million worth of sugarcane plantations in Cuba. Americans owned over $50 million worth of plantations in Cuba. And the total amount of profit made from the sugar industry coming out of Cuba was $100 million a year. $100 million a year of first one's $50 million worth of holdings and a yearly profit of $100 million. So there is great commercial concerns now about Cuba and keeping a stable Cuba. The second reason for American interest in the 1890s on Cuba comes back up to Mayen in number 2, and that is, wouldn't Cuba be a great naval base to protect American interests in the Caribbean? And especially interest that might someday lead to the long-awaited and desired Isthmian Canal, probably in Panama, maybe in Nicaragua, but somewhere in Central America, a canal to be built, especially after the gold rush in California showed how long it took to get around South America to get there. So there'd always been this desire to link the coasts of the United States to a canal, and if you're going to build a canal, it's going to be subject to attack from foreign powers. So to have a base in Cuba would be perfect to defend that. And then all the things in 1A through D factor into that also. The desire to spread American culture and the feeling that we are superior to the so-called little brown brothers, as they were called in Cuba, from a social Darwinist perspective. So in the mid-1890s, we are more focused on Cuba when trouble breaks out. And trouble breaks out kind of inadvertently due to our tariff policies. Listed number 9. The 1890 tariff, you remember this. What was it called? McKinley tariff. And it was sponsored by Ohio Senator Republican McKinley, future president. It's a tariff increase. Then in 1894, what tariff changed rates? Wilson-Gorman, which was a decrease because it was passed during Cleveland's administration. Wilson-Gorman tariff that had the income tax that was thrown out as unconstitutional. Now to confuse things, the McKinley tariff that raised rates had left Cuban sugar off the list. So even though tariffs went up in 1890, not on Cuban sugar. It was not taxed. But in 1894, the Wilson-Gorman tariff, which had a lot of opponents against it, added Cuba to the sugar list. Now, this had to do with the lobbying efforts of Louisiana sugar growers as well as the Hawaiians. So if you go from a high tariff to low tariff, it can actually hurt you if you went from a no tariff to a low tariff. So therefore, Cubans now are having to pay, or Cuban sugar is having to pay more taxes to get into the American market. that causes a slowdown, which is already aggravated by the panic of 1893 anyway. So there is a great backlog of unsold sugar in inventories. Spanish landlords lay off the workers who have no other way to make a livelihood, because growing sugar in Cuba is like growing cotton in the old South for a while. So unemployment looms, and not surprising, by 1895-96 there is a revolt that breaks out, Cuban revolt against the Spanish. One of the key figures who had been pushing for Cuban independence earlier than this was a intellectual revolutionary thinker, writer, and organizer named José San Martí. It's José Martí. He was executed and made a martyr by the Spanish in 1895. You may recall this, that in the 1980s, when the Reagan administration was working real hard on trying to stop the spread of communism after Nicaragua went leftist in the Grenada event, they put up a propaganda radio station that broadcasts in Spanish to Cuba, anti-communist thinking, called Radio Martí, trying to remind the Cubans to identify with a previous hero, not Castro, but the one who overthrew the Spanish way back. Well, the Spanish didn't negotiate or make promises or try to cajole them as they did in the 1878 arrangement. They instead sent counterinsurgency tactician Victoriana Whaler to crush the revolt. Whaler's tactics in item 10 involved going to areas of suspected insurgent activity, rounding up the rebels, placing them in concentration camps, and then systematically torturing them until they would reveal leaders of the revolution. It was part of the Whaler torture that killed Martí. This did not turn up the names of leaders. Instead, what it really did was it took neutral Cubans and added them to the revolution. It worsened things. By 1897, the Spanish had seen that the Whaler's actions were counterproductive and had recalled him from Cuba. And shortly thereafter, in 1897, after the recall of Whaler, there was a lag in the revolution. It wasn't over, but it had quelled down somewhat. Well, as I said, there's American focus and interest on what's happening here for future canal and for protecting business interests. Why this becomes mainstream knowledge has to do with the American press. So we move into number 12 here. In the late 1890s, American newspapers, at least American newspapers in major cities, kind of undergo a revolution of style. Prior to this, newspapers were not really newspapers because it was so long in getting news. It took weeks and months to get news of major events worldwide. So what would have happened is newspapers would be editorial on the front page and the first few pages, and the back page would be the news, which was old. And newspapers were decidedly partisan. You never had the idea of a neutral news account. It was you bought the newspaper of the ideology you already believed, reinforcing your prejudices. But in the 1890s, technology and other things start to change the nature of the papers. One of the reasons is the invention of the wire service, the Associated Press and Reuters, making it possible to get news instantly abroad in a day's time. So that pushes news to the front page because it's actually real and newsworthy. Papers start, especially in New York, we'll talk about a couple that do this, start engaging in other tactics to try to increase circulation. They find newer, cheaper ways to manufacture a cheaper grade of paper and drop the price of the newspapers to a penny. The penny paper comes into existence. They also add features such as comics, crossword puzzles, advice to the lovelorn, zodiac predictions, all these things to increase readers. In the comics, two particular newspapers listed in item 12 here, the New York Journal and the New York World, fought back and forth for trying to have the Yellow Kid cartoon, which became one of the first color-filled comic strips. New York and then elsewhere. And the Yellow Kid was so popular in both papers that eventually the New York newspapers and their style that I'm going to talk about came to be known as the Yellow Press. But that's not the only explanation. Historians really differ over how the term Yellow Press came to be. Some say it was because the cheap papers yellowed so quickly from the grade of paper used. But neither of that is the real definition of what Yellow Press means. Yellow Press then and now means exaggerative, sensational, National Enquirer type garbage, where you take things that may have had a kernel of truth to start with and you blow them up way out of proportion, looking for scandals, lurid details of stars, maybe girls who shaved their heads and tattooed their heads in Vegas or something like that, if they're important enough that that makes the headlines or something. And the two best at this, the two best Yellow Press journalists was William Randolph Hearst with his New York Journal and Joseph Pulitzer with the New York World. When we think of Pulitzer Prize, what does that bring to mind? Yeah, humanitarianism, good journalism, sound research based on accurate truth. Pulitzer put that prize together to try to deflect people's memory away from the fact that he, like Hearst, had done some of the best lying and exaggeration in news reporting. Which is why the New York Times, a smaller paper at this time, would not engage in Yellow Press journalism, and they made it clear by putting something on their masthead, which is still there today, which says what? I think it's still there, last time I saw it. What's on the top of the left part of the New York Times newspaper? Which declares its non-Yellow Press nature. All the news that's fit to print. And that was their way of saying, we're not going to engage in this lying campaign that these other papers are involved in. The Rolling Stone changed it to what? All the news that's fit. That's what's on their message. Well, Hearst and Pulitzer definitely became rich and powerful. Pulitzer papers included, do still today, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the New Orleans Picayune. Hearst had papers all over the country, from San Francisco Examiner to Chicago papers in New York. So through the wire services, these two publishers alone could pretty much dictate the news everybody else got, especially if smaller local newspapers through the wire services picked up what they brought together. When asked what news was really newsworthy and what wasn't, the Hearst response was, if the headline is big enough, the news is big enough. I always kept trying to convince the Portsmouth paper about that in regards to the Northside Quiz Bowl team. Because every time we won a big tournament, if you had that headline big enough on the front page, it would be news. But they never bought it. I never went for the first view. Hearst's life was thinly biographed in what film considered by some film buffs to be the best movie ever made. Yeah, Citizen Kane. So if you go out and rent Citizen Kane and watch Orson Welles in it, you'll see a lot of this history in there. It's Spanish-American War and the fight with Pulitzer and his attitude about publishing. Hearst, an extremely powerful person. Hearst, people don't realize, probably was the main reason FDR became a candidate in 1932. Hearst wanted it and was going to block everybody else. That's much later in life. But it's been considered that Hearst's very responsible for causing the Spanish-American War single-handedly. And we'll see how in a moment. So you really ought to watch Citizen Kane. There was a follow-up movie you may have seen called RKO 238, in which it was the making of Citizen Kane. And why did Hearst do what he did? I mean, why did Orson Welles do what he did to make that movie? That's really worth watching. Well, what Hearst and Pulitzer did is find out about what's happening in Cuba, sent reporters down to Cuba, sent the famous Indian artist George Remington, to cover what was happening in Cuba. Remington wrote back to Hearst, Whaler's been returned to Spain, and actually the revolution has slowed down. There is no revolt. I'm coming home soon. To which Hearst is said to have wired back, you furnish me the pictures, I'll furnish the war. So that's what Remington did. He went around and burned some huts and interviewed some people who'd been recently accosted by Spanish, which hadn't. Sent that back to Hearst, and Hearst published it. Pulitzer didn't want to be outdone, so he fabricated the same thing. And now we have American each day reading about all the cruelty that really had been going on earlier, but wasn't at that point, that the Spanish were dishing out to the Cubans. So you can see how that manipulated public opinion, because this, if we go back to 1A through D, this is in a time period when we feel like we've got to stand up to these Europeans. They're insulting our honor in our so-called backyard. That's always been one of my amazing things I hear on TV when they talk about the Caribbean or South or Central America, that it's in our backyard, like we own the yard. There were comments made about Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, that here he is flirting with Ahmadinejad from Iran, and are they going to have Islamic fundamentalism in our own backyard? Well, I didn't know Venezuela was our yard. I thought it was an independent country. But it's that kind of thinking that's prevalent in the 1890s, that America's influence is so strong, so powerful, that the Monroe Doctrine is now to be seriously reckoned with, that we have some duty to protect the Cubans from the Spanish. And it, again, to use the phrase that was used so often, the little brown brothers need to be given American civilization and culture. So that with the papers exaggerating what's happening, or at least fabricating really what's happening, and with commercial interests, naval strategic interests at work, things are moving in the direction for finding a way to get into war with Spain. And while those people behind the scenes, the gloomy, dark, bearded power brokers behind the scenes are working to start this war, I think the majority of American public opinion is sincerely wishing, gosh, somebody should protect the Cubans. It's a real sincere feeling. Here's an experience that I'm always reminded of. Before the Gulf War of 91 happened, there was on television, was it 60 Minutes, had an interview with a woman who said she was a nurse in one of the hospitals in Kuwait City. And she had testified before the United Nations as a nurse that Iraqi soldiers, when they came into Kuwait, went into the hospitals and killed patients, and especially took great glee in throwing babies off of incubators onto the ground and stabbing them with bayonets. Well, when the war was fully over, it was discovered that event never occurred. I'm not saying there wasn't atrocities, there were, but that particular event never occurred, and this woman who claimed to be a nurse was actually the ambassador's daughter, wasn't a nurse. But all that went on the American television, and that revved us up to the point that we need to be defending Kuwaitis. So there's lots of parallels there to that. Let's do 13 and 14 and then run away. So as 1897 turns to 1898, American public opinion is ever more inflamed by the yellow press journalism conflict going on. The Spanish ambassador to the United States in item 13 makes a real blunder in February of 1898. He writes a letter to a friend in Havana. This is the ambassador in Washington, D.C., Spanish ambassador, writes a letter to a friend in Havana, Cuba. Friend never got the letter because Hearst reporters stole it out of the post office and brought it back home and published it in the newspaper. The letter has Enrique Dupuy de Lomé saying about President McKinley that he was a weak, spineless, bitter of the masses. Translation, coward. And that McKinley will probably cave into American public opinion and go for war even though it's not what's appropriate and what's right. Well, once that's published, put in the newspapers, people are inflamed and outraged. Reminds me of back in the 80s. I was no Reagan fan at all. Definitely not a Reagan fan. But when the Russians said that Reagan's nothing but just a two-bit cheap actor cowboy, I thought, hey, wait a minute, that's my Republican president. That's my job to hate on him, not you guys. So you can imagine how unity fell behind McKinley against the Spanish for these comments. Even though at the same time this is happening, his future vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, had already also announced that he thought McKinley had the backbone of a chocolate eclair. But that's all right, because that's an American talking. You can do that. 6 days later, in item 14, the American gunboat, the Maine, which was stationed in Havana Harbor for the purpose of protecting American lives and property against any possible outbreak of violence, mysteriously explodes. February 15th, The main just blows up. To this day, there's no proven explanation. Conjecture's best guess is that it was a boiler room explosion by accident. But Hearst and Pulitzer, and especially Hearst, who starts this, had the answer immediately. It was the Spanish. He even put on the front page of his paper illustrations of where the Spanish mines were located just prior to explosion. And then future issues would show an illustration of flames and bodies flying up like 100 feet into the air from the ship. He was given his opportunity here. And that's where we'll pause and pick up with item 15 when we return.